The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
99.9% Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump has compared the wall he wants on the border with Mexico with what Israel has built. He says the wall in Israel is 99.9% effective.
Yes, absolutely. He is right.
That's one view from Israel, which, by the way, has two walls, one along the West Bank and one along the border with Egypt. And for many Palestinians, Trump's comparison is way off.
Neither are analogous to what Trump wants to do, and neither save anyone from the problems he claims it will solve.
Plus, China prepares to land a spacecraft on the moon right on schedule.
One great thing about the Chinese program is that they have a plan and they're sticking to it.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us. It is day 12 of the government shutdown, and finally, a meeting at the White House this afternoon to try to address the bottom line issue in the shutdown for President Trump, his plan for a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. A meeting, a negotiation, a briefing, not sure what to call it, but it was the first time Democratic leaders Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer met with Trump since the president said this at a meeting last month.
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck. I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it.
We all know Trump has since changed his mind about who's to blame. He says it's the Democrats who are obstructing him. As for the meeting this afternoon, it did not provide the breakthrough. Here's what one of the lawmakers at the meeting, top House Republican Kevin McCarthy, had to say on his way out.
We had a long discussion. The president asked us to come back on Friday after the leadership races. I think that was a concern for some people to be able to get through. We never did get through the complete briefing from the Secretary of Homeland, which we were concerned about because we do have a crisis on the border right now.
Democratic leaders say that's debatable. Anyway, while the scrum continues in Washington, what are the people on the other side of the border thinking? Jorge Castañeda was Mexico's foreign minister from 2000 to 2003. We reached him by phone from Mexico City. He says the first option of Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is to stay out of the fray.
What he's been doing is basically to turn the other cheek, make no statements of any sort, either himself or the foreign ministry, in terms that these practices that President Trump is implementing are unfriendly, hostile, and perhaps illegal, both regarding U.S. law and regarding Mexican law. That's the one he's using. I think that that's not going to work. The other one is risky, unquestionably, but at least has a chance of working, which is to fight back and to basically say, look, this is not acceptable. This is not friendly behavior among neighbors, among friends, among allies, among partners, and this has to stop. And if it doesn't stop, if you don't make a formal commitment not to fire tear gas across the border ever again, then we will take a series of measures somewhere along the border somehow that will be a form of retaliation or reprisal.
What might those measures actually be?
Of course, the most obvious one is for Mexico to walk back from this ridiculous agreement and accept it called Remain in Mexico, having Central Americans wait in Mexico while their asylum claims are processed in the United States. I don't even know if this has actually happened. Both governments announced it was going to happen. Mexico could simply walk away from that and say, look, under these conditions, we can't do that. Secondly, stop using Mexican authorities, Mexican police, Mexican army from deterring people to cross the border without papers if they want to try, which is what Mexico did only 2 or 3 weeks ago when there was a series of incidents in Tijuana and the Mexican police tried to stop the Hondurans from reaching the border. Mexico could simply say, look, we are not going to do that. If you want to stop them, you stop them, but we're not going to stop them, and we're not going to take them back either, by the way. So there are alternatives. I'm not saying they're not risky, but the current situation seems to be untenable.
So, Jorge Castañeda, what do you see as the best and worst case scenarios for the coming year at the border?
At the northern border, I think there will continue to be all sorts of tensions, incidents, episodes such as the ones we've seen the last month or so. There's a new caravan theoretically forming in Honduras, which is scheduled to leave San Pedro Sula on January 19th. That's what they're calling for. All of this is going to continue, as is, until there's a much more serious episode. Two children have already died. You know, one of these tear gas canisters happens to explode in a crowd or where there are children and one or two of them are also killed there, there would be all hell to pay, because that's the Americans killing people in Mexico but firing from the United States. Best case, I guess, would be that Trump becomes more reasonable, tries to get some kind of immigration reform done in the United States, tries to apply U.S. laws as they are on asylum issues.
Well, we sincerely hope that no more children die in either country. Jorge Castañeda, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jorge Castañeda is a former foreign minister in Mexico. We spoke by phone from Mexico City. A couple of days ago, Trump tweeted, "Everybody knows a wall will work perfectly. In Israel, the wall works 99.9%. This has been a talking point on the political right for years. Here's Tucker Carlson making fun of the Democrats on Fox News.
And that's the other point they keep making. Walls don't work. They're totally ineffective, except in prisons and the Vatican. Okay, but before we accept Chuck Schumer's claim about walls as fact, just one simple question. What about Israel?
So what about those walls? Israel has built two of them, one along its border with Egypt and one on the border with the occupied Palestinian territories. There are lots of people with lots of perspectives on Israel's walls. We're going to hear just two of them now. First, Shai Bazak. He's a former Israeli consul general in Boston and Miami. He's now in Tel Aviv. I asked him about Israel's wall along its southern border with Egypt. It's the one that's most comparable to what Trump is suggesting.
We have a very interesting border between us and Egypt. The length of the border is around 250 kilometers, which is around 170 miles, something like that, going on the desert, as I said. And before we have the fence, we have thousands of immigrants and many illegal immigrants coming every year, sometimes every month. And it was a huge burden. Since we stopped, established this fence, which took 3.5 years and almost $700 million to build it, in the last year, I believe 11 people came across this border.
There are many experts here in the United States who say, look, you can build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border as long as you want. There's still going to be people finding their way over or under it. So I want to know what makes that 150-mile wall dividing Israel and Egypt so effective. Like, are there special systems or technologies that are being used?
So we definitely have technologies, which is not enough, by the way. 3 years after they finished the wall, they put another fence to make it higher on top of the fence, which to make it more effective. But beside of that, of course, we have surveillance technologies all around the border. You can see what's going on there from control centers. The army is patrolling. Of course, our situation is not always the same as you have with Mexico.
Well, I was going to say, do you think Trump's...
In the sense of Israel, it works very good.
Mm. And so do you think Donald Trump's comparison between the U.S. southern border and the borders of Israel is kind of a false comparison?
I don't think it's false. I think he's right that it was successful in Israel. Is it going to solve the long border with Mexico, as you said, many times more than Israel? I don't know. Is it the same thing for the issues that you have with immigrants who are coming from there? So there are different issues, but it's very fair comparison that President Trump made when he compared the effectiveness of the wall in Israel. And everybody knows that Israel is not the United States, of course. There are many, many other issues there.
I hear some kids in the background. I suppose they're also agitated by the whole discussion of the wall.
Yes, it's 8 o'clock in the evening, and my twin daughters are now on the way to bed. They have a school day tomorrow morning, yeah. And I'm happy to hear their happy voices. Yes, from the other room.
So, Shai Bazak, let me ask you one more thing. Do you think Israeli leaders would have ever shut down their government if they didn't get money for their wall?
Oh, we don't have this kind of system that you have. We many, many times we in Israel are envy with you Americans for your amazing government system with the checks and balance, the president, the Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Parliament, and the Congress.
Really? You still see it as amazing? You still see it as amazing today?
We still see it amazing. I think your system, the wonderful constitution, which was written so many years ago and still so effective. And we sometimes envy with you. But, of course, there are issues that you have to address.
Shai Bazak is a former Israeli diplomat now based in Tel Aviv as a consultant. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
Okay, now to the other border wall that Trump seems to be referring to when he tweets about Israel. There's the border with Egypt we just heard about, and then there's the security barrier with the West Bank. Trump tends to conflate the two. A lot of people do. I asked Hussein Ibish at the Arab Gulf States Institute about that West Bank wall and about the comparison between it and Trump's proposed border wall with Mexico.
Well, it's absolutely silly. I mean, first of all, the wall in the West Bank has nothing to do with immigration. It's largely built outside of the borders of Israel. It's about 15% of it is along Israel's border with the occupied West Bank. The rest of it goes deep into the West Bank. And when the Israeli government was defending the route of the wall in court, they admitted that the wall, which was ostensibly to keep out suicide bombers, was actually mostly the root of it was being constructed for political reasons. And what Israel has done is use the wall to impose a de facto new border on the Palestinians who didn't agree to it and pretend that any settlement construction they do inside the route of that border is totally legitimate, even though it's not. What the wall really is part of a system of surveillance, domination, and control of a population by a hostile foreign army in order to facilitate a colonization program, a settlement program. That's what it's really about, and an attempted land grab. And so, you know, you're not talking about apples and oranges here. You're talking about apples and moon dust.
Well, let me get your take on that last kind of part of your answer, because for many people, a wall is a symbol of occupation and a reminder of land grabbing. I mean, Trump holds up Israel's wall as a model, though.
Well,
how does that make you feel?
Well, of course, it makes me feel disgusted because it's an extremely objectionable and aggressive act, and it was adjudicated at the International Court of Justice, which found that it was a human rights violation. So what Trump does essentially is say, oh, there's this very ugly, very illegal, very illegitimate thing that one of our friendly countries has done in someone else's country, and we are going to analogize our border efforts with that. It's crazy.
So how do you reconcile all of that with this very emotional argument that good walls make better neighbors?
Well, it's anachronistic because what it suggests is you put up a big wall and then it's us over here and you over there. Well, there's a couple problems with that, which is that if you over there want to come over here, there's a wall doesn't stop, including the Great Wall of China did not stop people from coming. Plus, we live in an interdependent world. There is no you over there and us over here and never the twain shall meet. We've got to deal with people and we need, obviously, lots of travel back and forth. And walling ourselves off is a paranoid and an irrational response to a set of problems that are largely not caused by immigration or even by illegal immigration, but are the result of technological, economic, and social changes. But I think what you're getting at is that there's a symbolic resonance that a wall has, right? It's a defiant thing. It's a monument to disliking the person on the other side of it. It's a sculpture, almost, about a separation. And there, I think, yes, if you want to waste your money in your own country on building an artistic representation of your dislike of your neighbors, you can do that if you want to. But I would suggest that it doesn't get anybody what they need.
Hussein Ibish with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump said today he will keep the government shut down for as long as it takes. Not welcome words to federal employees and contractors who currently are not getting paid. Thousands of people are furloughed, but many of them are required to work anyway without pay because their job is keeping people safe. Celia Hahn is a Transportation Security Administration officer at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport.
It's stressful. People are stressed. Not everybody can, you know, make it if they don't get their paychecks on time. We have a lot of employees here that are married to each other or married to other federal employees at other agencies that are on furlough also. So we've, you know, families that their income is completely uncertain at the moment. It's tough to try to figure out exactly what's going on, what's going to happen.
Han is also a union official, and she says a lot of people are looking to the union for help.
People have been asking about whether the union itself has any financial assistance available to people if this goes on too long. Other questions, people's medical benefits, whether the coverage is going to lapse if there's no paychecks to deduct the premiums from.
Han is concerned about long-term damage as well.
We've had an issue with the agency having low morale as it is. The whole shutdown stuff has not helped the morale at all.
In some respects, though, TSA agents and other federal employees are lucky. They'll likely get their back pay once the shutdown is over. Many employees of companies working on contract for the federal government, though, people like janitors and cleaners at museums who've been furloughed during the shutdown, they might never be compensated for their lost work time. Humanity has never stepped foot on the far side of the moon. That is the side of the moon that can never be seen from Earth. We humans haven't even managed to land an object there until now. A Chinese spacecraft is set to touch down there any day now. David Blewett is a lunar scientist with the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University. First of all, David, for anyone who spent a lot of time listening to a certain album by Pink Floyd, I got to say I'm kind of appalled to learn there is no dark side of the moon. What is that all about?
Yeah, well, sure. There's no side of the moon that's permanently dark, except during lunar nighttime, just as during the night on Earth, half the Earth is dark, right?
Right.
So there is, as you said, there's the near side, which the moon always keeps one face turned towards the Earth. That's the only side we can see from the Earth. But the far side gets the same amount of sunlight as does the near side. It's just we can't see it directly from the Earth.
Right. So here in Boston, I'm only going to see one face of the moon. And if I stay here all my life, that's the only face I'm going to see.
Yes. No matter where you are on the Earth, you'll only see that one side.
So people have never landed an object on this far side of the moon before. How come? What's so hard about it? And how have the Chinese succeeded or are about to succeed, it seems?
Yeah, well, The obstacle, of course, is that if you're on the far side, you cannot have direct radio communications with the Earth. So that adds to the expense of any mission you might want to fly. So to overcome this, what China did maybe, I don't know, 7 or 8 months ago, was to put a relay satellite in orbit around the moon. And from this relay satellite, the satellite can see both the far side of the moon and can see the Earth. So radio signals can travel up from the lander up to the relay satellite and then be sent on to the Earth. So there's this extra step that's required to communicate from the far side.
It's not like the days with the Apollo missions that were capturing that great movie The Dish with Sam Neill, where they had to get a satellite dish in some sheep meadow in Australia to do the far side of the moon communication.
Yeah, right. Of course, when the astronauts, you know, when the orbiting command module went around the backside, they were out of communications
right.
for a time.
So what's going to happen once the spacecraft lands there? It's unmanned, right?
Yeah. So this is a robotic probe. It is more or less a copy of the mission that China flew 5 years ago that consists of a lander and a rover. So the lander will set down on the surface. And then the little rover, a six-wheeled little robotic car, will drive off. And there are experiments both on the lander and on the rover. And the rover will drive around and explore its environment using a number of scientific instruments.
Yeah, so 5 years ago, that was Chang'e 3. This is Chang'e 4. What does Chang'e mean?
Chang'e is the name of a mythological goddess in the Chinese tradition. A woman who, I think maybe to escape her husband, flew up to the moon.
Interesting. One of the things I read that China's going to be experimenting is whether silkworms can lay eggs in zero gravity. Did I get that right?
Yeah. Apparently, there's going to be this, there's a sealed container that contains some plant seeds and also these silkworm eggs. And the idea is that the plants will sprout and the silkworm eggs will hatch and the little worms will eat the leaves, and we'll get to watch this via a little camera beam back from the far side of the moon. Should be pretty remarkable.
That does sound pretty wild. So is the idea that eventually there will be silk emerging from these worms?
Perhaps, yeah, I guess.
China's going to corner the market on moon silk.
Yeah, that would fetch quite a price, I'm sure.
So all kidding aside, I mean, what does this tell us about the state of the Chinese space program compared to the U.S. space program?
Yeah, well, the one great thing about the Chinese program is that they have a plan and they're sticking to it, which is something because they don't have a congressional budget cycle and change of administrations that they can do. So they've been following this very orderly lunar exploration program. They had two orbiting spacecraft, Chang'e 1, Chang'e 2, and then they did this 5 years ago, this lander Chang'e 3. Now they're going to repeat that similar mission, except on the far side. And then coming up, I believe later in 2019, there's going to be Chang'e 5, which is actually going to collect samples of rocks and soil and bring them back to the Earth. So that will be the first time we have any new samples from the moon since the Soviet probe in 1976.
Mm. How excited are you by what China's doing with their lunar missions?
Oh, it's tremendous. You know, as a lunar and planetary scientist, it's good to see exploration being done. Unfortunately, you know, there is a law that precludes NASA-funded scientists from directly collaborating with Chinese researchers. So, for instance, this Chang'e 4 mission, it includes instruments, one from Germany and one from Sweden. But the U.S. would be precluded by this law from participating on the Chinese mission in that way.
David Blewett with the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Glad to speak to you.
I'm Marco Werman. Two women walked into a Hindu temple today in the Indian state of Kerala, defying a tradition that bans women from setting foot inside. Now their lives are in danger.
Which is why the police is giving them security throughout and their location is being kept a secret.
That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Do you know what it takes to organize several million people and get them all to stand in a line to protest? That's exactly what happened in the state of Kerala in southern India. Officials there say millions of women created a nearly 400-mile human chain in support of gender equality, and specifically in support of two women who decided to enter a sacred Hindu temple. The shrine is at the center of a dispute as to whether women between the ages of 10 and 50 are allowed in. Conservative Hindus, including many members of India's ruling BJP party, are against it. They've long banned women of menstruating age from even setting foot inside the sacred space. We asked Danya Rajendran to tell us more. She's editor of the News Minute in Bangalore.
In September, the Supreme Court overturned the ban. For the last 96 days, there have been efforts by various women to enter this temple. But the BJP, certain right-wing organizations, certain Hindu organizations had been camping at Shabrimala, and they created a hostile environment for women. And I think around 10 women had tried to enter the Shabrimala shrine, but none of them were allowed. They were heckled, they were booed, and the police had to basically escort them back. But on January 2nd, in the wee hours of January 2nd, actually, around 3:30, two women went inside the Shabrimala temple. That was a time when not too many devotees were there. And that's the only reason why they could enter.
What can you tell us about these two women who did this? Who are they?
The two women who entered Shabrimala are in their 40s. One is Bindu Amini. She's a lawyer. She's currently a lecturer in a law college in Kerala. The other woman, Kanaka Durga, she is a government employee. We do not know much about her. Both of them met actually on a Facebook group, which was talking about Renaissance. And it was basically a Facebook group connecting women who wanted to go to Shabrimala. So they met on that Facebook group and they decided to go. And no one had a clue where these people were for the last 7 days. In fact, Kanaka Durga's family had filed a police complaint saying she's missing. It was only today that even the family discovered that she had been staying in a hotel without telling anyone, and they went to Sabarimala. So it is a complete operation done stealthily by the women with the support of the Kerala police.
That's fascinating. So, Danya, do you know what happened when they arrived in the temple and took their places there?
So the temple is a few kilometers away from this place called Pamba. They arrived at Pamba around 1 a.m. and they started climbing the hill from 1:30 is what we're being told. They reached the temple around 3:30. They prayed. They came back running down and they were taken away in police vans. The entire day, camera crews have been trying to find them, but the police have kept their locations quite secret. There have been attempts to attack their houses. In fact, we have seen in the past when whenever women try to enter the Sabarimala shrine, there have been coordinated attacks on their workplaces, on their houses. So their families are in considerable risk at this point of time. The women themselves are at risk, which is why the police is giving them security throughout and their location is being kept a secret.
So those police who accompanied them, has there been any criticism of the police?
Yes, there's been a lot of criticism of the police and the government. In fact, throughout the day, we have seen violent protests in many districts across the state of Kerala. In Thiruvananthapuram, the capital city, tensions escalated at least for 2 to 3 hours. Tomorrow, there's a shutdown in Kerala, and we do not know if more violent protests will happen.
Now, presumably, these protesters who oppose these two women going to the temple, they are in the presence of 10 to 50-year-old women all the time in the course of their days. Why are they so opposed to women entering this temple? Maybe you can tell me why this temple is so revered.
So the protesters are not just men. There are women also amongst the protesters. In fact, when the Supreme Court judgment came, we saw thousands of women on the streets of Kerala actually saying that they do not want to enter the temple. The deity of the temple is called Lord Ayyappa. This particular temple believes that Ayyappa is a celibate god. And so they do not want women of menstruating ages to go to the temple in case they end up enticing the god.
So, of course, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, he's part of the BJP, he's the head of the party. What has he said about this whole episode now that it's reached this fever pitch?
Well, the Prime Minister in a television interview just yesterday actually said that Sabarimala, according to the BJP, is a tradition and a tradition cannot be broken. So that's the BJP stand. The BJP President Amit Shah and the Prime Minister both saying the same thing, that it is tradition of the temple and they will not support any ruling of the Supreme Court which goes against the tradition.
Yesterday, the local coalition government in Kerala organized a women's wall in which women from across Kerala formed this nearly 400-mile human chain to protest the ban from them entering the temple. There was this video taken from a car window, and you just see the line of women going on and on and on. It's really impressive. What was the reaction to that, and has it helped the women gain allies?
Definitely. I mean, it's not a small feat to actually get 3 to 4 million women on the streets. They took that pledge saying that we stand for renaissance, we stand for equality, and we stand for feminism. So I personally thought it was a great moment as far as the feminist political movement in Kerala goes. The fact that so many women came together to take that pledge is simply a beginning, I hope, for better feminist politics in Kerala.
So the people who don't like this ruling of the Supreme Court that women should be allowed to enter the Sabarimala temple, I mean, what's going to happen now? Are those protests going to continue?
I think the protests will definitely continue. In fact, the protests, I think, will strengthen now. The petition is going to come up in the Supreme Court again on the 22nd of January. And if the Supreme Court upholds the Constitution Bench's verdict, then we will see more protests.
Danya Rajendran speaking with us from Bangalore, India. Thank you.
Thank you.
Several million women in solidarity. That is a lot. 5.5 million people is the number of Syrians who fled their country since the outbreak of civil war there 7 years ago. Many of them have settled into new homes in new countries, but thousands are still in the limbo of refugee camps. Many of these camps are run by the UN High Commission for Refugees. The largest is in Jordan, the Zaatari refugee camp. There are many services at Zaatari. One of them is a program for girls called Tiger, for These Inspired Girls Enjoy Reading. Nida Yassin works at the Zaatari camp, and she recently produced an audio diary of her work for our colleagues at the BBC.
Hello, this is Nida. I am here at the UNHCR Refugee Registration Center in Jordan. This center is the largest in the Middle East. We process around 3,000 to 5,000 individuals per day. The sound you hear around me is about 300 refugees waiting for their interviews. There are 56 different nationalities that are registered, but the majority are, of course, Syrian refugees. I've moved to one of the interview rooms in the registration center where my colleague Omar is meeting with a family to take more information and update their files. There's a little girl here trying to get away from her sister. The process takes about 15 to 20 minutes to renew their asylum seeker certificate. I'm in one of UNHCR's vehicles heading to Za'atari refugee camp, which is the world's largest camp for Syrian refugees. Za'atari was opened in July of 2012 and today has around 80,000 refugees registered and residing in it. 55% of those are children under the age of 18. During my university studies, my mom always encouraged me to study and work hard so that I can join the UN. You see, my dad was a refugee, and with all these stories that he told me about, I thought that, yes, I would fit perfectly in a job like that. And I wanted to work with the UN, and I wanted to pay back for what my dad had received. I'm approaching the entrance of Za'atari camp now. Hopefully meet some of the girls that are a part of the TIGER program. TIGER basically stands for These Inspired Girls Enjoy Reading. Now being approached by Malak, who is 7 years old. Malak means angel in Arabic.
توقعت انه تايجر انه بس بالمخيم اللي بيعرفوه طلع انه مشهور والكل بيعرفه حتى عمان حتى الاردن.
I thought that tiger was only known, this is Suhaima, was only known on a camp level. Now everyone knows about it and I'm so proud to be a part of this program.
يوم تسجلت بالتايجر قررت اني اصير محاميه.
جميل كثير. Tasneem says that ever since she was little, she was hoping to become a housewife and stay at home and have people take care of her. Now, after joining Tiger, now she wants to become a lawyer.
That audio diary from Nida Yassin, a worker at the Za'atari refugee camp in Jordan. The camp shelters 80,000 Syrian refugees, the largest number anywhere. That also makes Za'atari the fourth largest city in Jordan. We're going to rewind to another time now, another country and another war, Vietnam, and an almost forgotten place in Saigon called Seoul Alley. Saigon was the capital of South Vietnam during the U.S. war there. Seoul Alley was an oasis for African-American soldiers, where they could hang out in their own bars, clubs, and restaurants. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen.
Bring up Saigon's Seoul Alley to people who were there in the 60s and 70s. You might hear about the R&B clubs. Some will bring up the tailor shop that made the same sharp-looking suits you could find in Harlem. But just about everyone mentions the food.
So, Ali, you could eat the same soul food that you ate in the United States. And the GIs were like, man, it was amazing because the Vietnamese could cook anything and they could cook it exactly the way it was in the States.
Ted Irving is a Houston filmmaker. He's 49, so he was just a baby during Seoul Alley's heyday. But he has talked to the guys who hung out there, guys who light up when you mention Seoul Alley and the food.
Chitlins, slaw, beans, sweet potatoes, candy yam, cornbread for $2.50. And if anybody did any time in Saigon, they'd know about this place. Yeah.
That's from a still unreleased documentary called Seoul Alley. Irving tracked down black Vietnam War vets and asked, what do you remember about Seoul Alley?
The vets would look at me like, how do you know about that? Because that's something that they just kind of kept to themselves. That's not anything that they went around and even told family about. It's just a sort of a private joy, just something that they can reminisce upon.
There's a reason you might not mention Seoul Alley to your mom. These guys weren't just sitting around eating food from home. This was your typical wartime party spot. Booze, brothels, drugs, all the things sought out by combat-ravaged young men. There was a similar place across town, of course, one that was dominated by white GIs. But when black soldiers tried to drink over there, they'd encounter lots of country music and racist white guys looking for a fight. So they created their own haven. One where the bars played soul instead of country.
They had clubs that catered to black GIs. And whenever you would see a white GI there, it's usually somebody that was brought in.
Me Dan is black. And they call the white guys Me Chung. That's white. But Me Dan, black, Me Chung, white. It wasn't racist, you know, like it's just, you know, like they say soul brother. It wasn't disrespectful in a disrespectful way.
People also called Soul Alley 100 P Alley. The P is for piaster, the currency under French occupation. But no matter what people called it, Irving says this gathering place helped many black soldiers keep from cracking under pressure.
You don't have anyone there to help you cope. There's no therapist there. There's no one to let you sit on their couch or lay on their couch and express yourself, shoulder to lean on. So they recreated this neighborhood of their own. That's something, I guess, to keep your mind off the war, off the horrors of the war.
Now, many vets who spoke to Irving also reminisced about the Vietnamese women working in Soul Alley. But what's missing from the film is the voices of those women, women who turned to sex work in an economy ruined by U.S. bombs. And as in so many wars, soldiers of all races left behind children and then tried to forget about them once they got back home.
They admitted, hey, every now and then, kind of creeps back in the head. They kind of, hey, I wonder what my child is doing, you know, what my son or daughter, who are they? How was their life?
One vet opens up to Irving, describing the moment he saw the baby he'd fathered with the woman he met in Soul Alley.
And that's what I looked at, because my mother's feet, her toes and my toes looked alike, and this kid had toes like mom, you know. That was, I think I saw the child one other time after that, and from that I lost contact with her.
That veteran named Robert Rice, now in Tennessee, he says he did try to find the child again before the war ended. But this was almost impossible once communist forces won and chased all the Americans out. That was the end of Soul Alley. Today, Saigon is called Ho Chi Minh City. And if you try to find Soul Alley, well, good luck.
It just looks like a normal street in Ho Chi Minh City. I mean, there are people hanging out and drying their clothes on lines, you know, a little cat here and there, dog. It's, you know, people just kind of out on their steps.
Nearly 50 years later, Irving says there's no trace of the raucous sanctuary that once was. Soul Alley, for the most part, only lives on in the faded memories of veterans. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo flew to Colombia today to speak with government officials there. One big item on the agenda, the crisis in neighboring Venezuela. Colombia is the largest recipient of Venezuelan refugees. It's already accepted more than 1 million people. Here's what the country's president, Iván Duque, says about it.
So I have decided that we're not going to close the border. We have to give them support.
Duque's advisor on Venezuelan border issues is Felipe Munoz Gomez. He says Colombia has received international help, but they're going to need a lot more.
I mean, it's so behind that the amount that we need just to tackle with this massive migration process.
You're saying you need a lot more money, a lot more resources to deal with this.
Yes. For example, we have received more than 35,000 kids in our school system. We have attended more than 50,000 kids between 0 and 5 years. We have Venezuelans in the hospital with a very complicated health issues, tuberculosis. And of course, this is a massive, massive challenge for Colombia. But as the president said, we are committed to help the Venezuelan people. And we have to organize all our system, the health system, the education system, just to receive the Venezuelans as they receive us.
When did they receive Colombians? When the Civil War was going on and Colombians were
refugees
all over. Yeah.
Yes, 20 years ago, there was a massive migration from Colombia to Venezuela, and they received us more than 3 million Colombians. They are now, we have like an historic responsibility, and we have like an ethical mandate, and we have the political decision led by the President Duque to receive the Venezuelans.
I mean, that number of people does create a lot of pressure on finite resources. How have Colombians, like average Colombians, been receiving the Venezuelans so far?
We haven't experienced yet a big xenophobic movement, but we have experienced in some parts of the country, of course, some protests of the citizens said that they are also Colombians and they also need support. Then we are working a threefold strategy that we are helping the migrants, but also we are helping the Colombian returnees. And at the same time, we are helping the host communities.
So are you seeing some Colombians who fled during the Civil War, who fled to Venezuela, and now with the crisis in Venezuela, they're coming back to Colombia?
Yes, near to 500,000 are returning. Then we have received more than 1 million just Venezuelan people, but moreover that, we have received around 500,000 Colombians that are returning to the country because they don't have any service, any health, any food. There are some people just to cross the border and to travel 14 hours from Caracas to the border. I think the magnitude of the crisis, we need to be aware of what is happening here.
What are the Venezuelans who are getting refuge in Colombia? What are they saying?
Some of them are asking for a refugee status, but the others are receiving another protection measures, the temporal permit that they allow them to stay here for 2 years and they can get a work. I travel to the border every week, and the stories that I hear and that I saw there are really, really dramatic. But it's really, really the worst humanitarian crisis that I think the world is experiencing now, maybe after Syria.
That was Felipe Munoz Gomez. He is Colombia's President Ivan Duque's advisor for the Colombian-Venezuelan border. Staying on things Colombian for now, because I'm a big fan of the Colombian group Bomba Estéreo. The band is touring these days in support of their most recent album. It's called Ayo, and when they came through Boston recently, I sat down with the band's founder, Simon Mejia. He's thinking about a lot of things these days, including the fate of the Amazon rainforest, which runs through parts of Colombia. It's a theme Mejia's band touches on in their song Siembra.
It's like common knowledge that the Amazon is the lung of the world, you know? But people don't know really what this really means. It happens that the Amazon is the main producer of water and oxygen for the world.
So it's not just personal for you, it's for the whole planet, really.
It's for the whole planet, yeah, it's for the whole planet.
The Amazon is for the whole planet, so if you live on planet Earth, you have a role to play in protecting it. That's why Simon Mejia isn't just using his music to raise awareness about the fate of the Amazon. He's also trying to learn as much as he can about ways to turn the tide on deforestation and environmental damage in general. On his recent visit to Boston, Simon paid a visit to a friend of his at MIT who's researching innovative conservation practices, things like alternatives to wood for construction and ways to build a forest economy that keep the trees standing.
It's very interesting because they, in the laboratories and everything, are developing these new ways of finding a more sustainable way of production, investigating with biomaterials, with recycling tires, using less water, and it's really, really interesting. And the good thing is that this kind of research is very rare in Colombia. So if we can have people like doing that kind of projects and applying them to countries that are so threatened as Colombia or Brazil or whatever, I think it would be a great success. And we're working toward that in this campaign as well. We're planning to do some workshops with these MIT guys. If that happens and we have support from the Colombian government and everything, I think it's going to be awesome because it's like the solutions and that involve the people that are in search for work and they don't have work, so they have to go and tear down the forest.
It's really impressive because I know a number of musicians who have written songs about the environment and their concern for environmental destruction, but you seem really deep into it, like you want to know more? And is this kind of a pivot point for you as a musician?
Yeah, I think my internal process has to do a lot with the Colombian folk music. And I think music is very, very deep involved with nature. It comes from nature. And in Colombia, it's more strong because we have the cumbia, for example, it's totally dependable to a river that crosses Colombia and to forests where the material to make the flutes come and everything. So I see if a world without forests and with rivers dying and everything is would be like a world without music, and that would be no fun.
Yeah, a world without forests and rivers would be like a world without music. Neither one's a world I, and safe to say you, want to live in. Simon Mejia and his band Bomba Estéreo are back in Colombia and about to undertake a special tour at home. It includes shows in venues near the Colombian Amazon aimed at highlighting the urgency of protecting the forest. Mejia says even if their message connects with only a handful of people, that's a good start. And that'll do it for us today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.